All right, welcome back. So, you know, in here I thought that we had appropriated enough money for technology upgrades. But if everyone could just project their voices to make sure that everyone can be heard, and we're going to continue on because this is such an important discussion today, and I'm excited. That's why we still had committee at 8:30 a.m. So happy to have everyone here. Mr. Aldrich, if you want to take over.
Thank you very much. So we started last July, so we may only in line with the appropriation language. Our main partners are the state colleges and universities, not our only partners, but principally through the University of West Florida, Florida International University, and University of South Florida. The next slide, please. We now have over 40 offerings available, 43 to be exact. Part of them are on this slide. I'll call out a couple because of what's going to be talked about later today. At least two of the offerings through the University of West Florida are about artificial intelligence and machine learning. One is the introduction to what they are, the other is the application. And we'll continue here to the next slide, please. We've got off to a little bit of a slow start. At the end of October, we had about 2,000 participants. Now we got about 4,000. I'm optimistic the way things are going, that's going to double again before the end of March. And we need to drill down into those a little bit and see who's attending and who's not attending. There's roughly 10 times as many local government employees as there are state employees. So the numbers, you know, reflect that pretty much. A little over 3,000 local government employees, about 150 or so state employees. But we want to look and see where they're coming from. We're going to do a little more homework when we get back and report back to Bruce and the team. So we'll make sure we solicit some help in getting to those areas that aren't being covered or individuals that may not be participating at this time. It's a little bit of a heat map. We'll drill down on that. We realize we also have to take into consideration the population density in some of those counties. Just because X number of people are attending doesn't mean they're the most involved. We'll do that as well. And again, on this slide, and it relates to Brian Langley, who's going to follow me, we look at the areas where there is no involvement this time, and we'll reach out and talk to officials in those areas and try to change that. In terms of funding, we're doing well. We intend to continue working with the partners through 30 June of 2025. And we have some funding to do other things. And I'll call out a couple other things that we're doing because I think they're important. It's not just the 43 classes that are available online and sometimes in person, but we're working with organizations to address requirements that aren't necessarily being met by the universities. For example, the FDLE folks, the Cyber Bureau, and the Windward Yale and the IG, others too, but personally those two have indicated it would be nice to have agents who had a better understanding of what a cybercrime investigation looks like and how it's supposed to be conducted. So we reached out, we're partnering with the National White Collar Cyber Crime Center, which some of you may know is funded by the Department of Justice, but they're not funded to do traveling presentations as well. So we're going to fund them to come into the state starting this month. We're going to 6 different locations to have 3-day in-person sessions on how do you conduct a cybercrime investigation. And I anticipate that's going to grow. It's an election year, obviously, so another thing that we did was reach out to Norwich University, the White Research Institute. They're very experienced in conducting election security tabletop exercises. We're going to do that in May. We've already started the prep work with scenario development and objectives for about 11 counties around the Tampa area. And we're going to do something similar to that, working with CISA and with others in the Panhandle and in South Florida, because it's a certainly an important thing to do, and we have the funding available to do that. And we won't restrict the partnerships, if you will, just to the state universities and colleges or the institutions I just mentioned, but as other requirements are developed, we'll find a solution. That could be a vendor solution, but we'll continue to do those things. The next steps include increased marketing efforts. We're doing some things there. For example, on the 31st of January, PAGESA has their winter symposium in Orlando. So I'll be there. So I know some folks from Florida Digital Service will be there. Florida International University, again, an opportunity to talk to city managers and leaders about what we're doing and solicit their additional feedback. Brian, who's going to follow me, is talking about some things that they're doing with the risk assessment program. And that's an example related to the education and training, because as they go around and conduct the program, they find out what is needed in the organizations. About half those organizations, for example, said they don't believe their leaders outsiders starting to put into place a effective program. So some of the offerings that we listed before address things that you must know as a leader and manager in order to have an effective cybersecurity program. It would help if we had continued endorsement from senior officials stating this is important. I expect supervisors should be supporting. You know, people who attend the classes, they're free to all offer, all those who attend. And I'll call out one thing in particular on the 43 offerings. Some of those are for individuals to prep and take industry recognized certification exams. So you go through the classes, you think you know enough now to take the CompTIA or one of the other exams. You get a voucher number, they'll take the exam, so the program funds for the whole And so a lot of good things happening there. And we'll continue to engage, as I mentioned, with other individuals who might be able to help us and expand the program based on the requirements that people have. If an organization has requirements, either that are called out in the assessment or in other venues, we'll find a solution. I'll be happy to address any questions at this time.
We're going to do questions at the end during the panel discussion, so we'll let you each of you present first.
Thank you,
Mr. Aldrich. Next up, we have Brian Langley, Senior Executive Advisor, Cyber Florida, University of South Florida.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning. Thank you, everybody. So a critical infrastructure risk assessment. Basically, for Florida, we're leading the nation in developing a risk assessment that looks at all 16 sectors. This is unique and dynamic in many respects. When you look at emergency management, there's emergency support functions in the emergency operations centers, looking at cascading events as it relates to natural disaster. What Florida has done is fundamentally shifted our viewpoint to look at a disaster as it relates to cyber, impacting all 16 sectors at a simultaneous time, because any event could happen in any sector. So the goal here is to conduct a risk assessment, provide guidance, information, baseline information sharing to you as policymakers, but also importantly to the risk assessment itself, the critical infrastructure. What gaps, what vulnerabilities, what resources, what things that they can do. So let me get in with a quick journey. A critical infrastructure, for instance in Miami-Dade, now has access, free access to the cybersecurity evaluation tool that we created with our partners, both with the state agencies, associations, and organizations, to allow them to make informed decisions about their gaps, their analysis, what technology to purchase, what kind of training tools should you go to, what kind of resources can I provide to make sure that these individuals have the needs? We're talking about mom and pop critical infrastructure sectors who may not have the means, the resources, the tools, or the training. So we can now map them to information. There's over 520 critical infrastructure sectors participating in your cybersecurity evaluation tool. That is a remarkable, actually, opportunity for us to provide you anecdotal information, visual intelligence, analyzing what risks are out there and how we can anecdotally support those critical infrastructure sectors with their basic needs. And what you see in front of you is just a very small snapshot of some of the information that we provided to those individuals. Let me briefly talk about the return on investment. For a critical infrastructure right now, to receive your support and funding from the cybersecurity evaluation tool, they get a free risk assessment, which usually costs thousands of dollars. In addition to that, they get free reports that provide them information about how to support them on their gaps, their vulnerabilities, their risks, but most importantly, their investments. In addition to that, we've also cultivated tabletop exercises, incident response plans, working with our partners in emergency management, FLDS, and others, to ensure that as you have those gaps, what can we do to plug in those gaps right now to mitigate those risks? Be advised that critical infrastructure impacts the things we do on a daily lives. If you look at all 16 and all 54 subsectors, that is a lot of risk happening at once. What can we do to provide support and support to those small businesses and those sectors now? In addition to that, we can actually advocate some of the resources that the state has invested in right now. We started with 125 critical infrastructure contacts back when we started this in October. Right now, we have over 9,000 critical infrastructure contacts that we can engage with information, the risk assessment, which is free, resources which have been created, leveraging our friends at Fort Law Enforcement, the tools and the resources they have, particularly looking at law enforcement itself. This gives us enhanced situational awareness. That is why other states, commonwealths, universities, and colleges are asking, what is the things that we are doing here in Florida? Because we are looking at all 16. Some states, nothing wrong with that, are looking at any center. We're looking at all across trusted sectors, which enhances our ability to make informed decisions and allows you, for us, to provide you with data, graphics, visualization tools, so you can use that to look at what we can do. The other return on investment is what we've taken is workforce development, skills set, to ensure we have the best information available to help people make informed decisions about increasing and focusing on workforce development. And that's what this assessment is doing. It not just takes the gaps, the vulnerabilities, and the weaknesses, it also takes the workforce development. And the last thing we want to try to do with the assessment of this program is develop maturity. As we're going to hear today about AI and technology, what can we do to increase our ability to be resiliently mitigated against any future threats? And a maturity model has that. The last thing I want to offer is this. Next slide, please. Is what does the state receive? What do our policymakers receive? County commissioners, mayors, and others? The information that we're collecting from the CSET gives them the opportunity to look at what's going on in the backyard, and we can actually allocate additional resources to them. So the state receives CSET data, information that you haven't seen before because we now conduct their investments in an evaluation tool. Intelligence assessments. We can now share information on what's happening in our critical infrastructure communities. Policy reports. We're pushing out a policy report on ransomware, which we're going to be sharing with you, so you can see some of the information we're getting from our critical infrastructure sector in our communities. And lastly, visualization. We would like to visualize our information sharing with you to see real time what's happening in our critical infrastructure sectors. So the recommendations that we created in the report back in June of 2023 is what we're really fundamentally trying to focus on. Your investments is helping to feed the nation, which is why we have so many people asking, what is Florida doing here? It's astounding, really amazing. In addition to that, with the recommendations we have in place, that is going to increase the resilience of our communities in times of need, particularly in times of a cyber attack. So thank you so much very much for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Langley. Next up, we will be hearing from Melinda Miguel, Florida Chief Inspector General, Executive Office of the Governor.
Chair, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk with you today about a couple of things. I will present on the Cyber Pathways Program and enterprise audit activities at the Florida Inspector General Bureau. We want to discuss the Cyber Pathways Program along with our training and micro-learning strategies for some just-in-time learning that we're using for the auditors and investigators. Florida Inspectors General, as we embrace legislation that passed this House Bill 1297 in 2021, we knew that specialized knowledge and competence were very important within the IG community. The way forward included a $1 million appropriation, and so the Cyber Pathways Program was created to upskill and fill talent gaps within our existing workforce. This training on a variety of cyber auditing techniques and industry certifications, such as the Certified Information Systems Auditor, plus training for OIG investigators, were extremely important. These strategies have increased the expertise of the offices of inspectors general, empowering our team and help the agencies detect gaps in compliance with industry standards and rules, and aids in ensuring steps are taken to mitigate new and evolving cyber risks in our state agencies. You can see on this slide the three main categories with a short description of the actual way we've divided that $1 million for this training, the tools, and the audit enablement. And we have sought to continue that $1 million investment in the coming year with the governor's grants. This slide actually shows some of the offerings that we are providing to the Inspector General community. We have 8 major offerings along with 4 certifications that we've hosted over the last 2.5 years for over 300 auditors and investigators. staff can invest in more than one of these offerings to improve their readiness for this mission. In this last year, we expanded our offerings with no cost in a partnership with a provider that's offering this training to offer this training to include internal auditors and inspector general employees in the 12 public universities, 5 water management districts, city, county, and clerks of court offices of inspectors general. We have embraced House Bill 1297 in 2021. At that time, we only had 8 certified information systems auditors across state agencies as an example. Today, we have over 31 inspector general staff that have achieved this designation, and more are in the pipeline for this and other important credentials. We have also continued to invest in specialized technology skills for both the auditors and the investigators. As you know, state agencies in Florida have adopted Rule 60GG, Florida Administrative Code, that the state's IT professionals and programs are required to follow. To make that process somewhat simple for ingesting in this sort of forum, I have a slide here that's pretty customary and sourced from the NIST cybersecurity framework. It kind of demonstrates those 5 functions that are on the left-hand side of the screen with a descriptor of that function, along with the categories. There's 23 categories in this NIST cybersecurity framework. That gives us a total of 108 controls that are important, 40 of which we consider 40 of the core controls for the NIST cybersecurity framework that are kind of summarized here in this graphic. This is going to be important because it'll kind of guide you through the next steps of the audits that have been selected over the last 2.5 years and then going into fiscal year 24-25. Our audits test for compliance to the rule and to this NIST cybersecurity framework outlined here. Regular audits help to identify vulnerabilities and weaknesses in the systems or in the environment. We have organized an enterprise audit approach across the Inspector General community to work hand in hand to validate the state agency's compliance with these NIST functions and categories. I will summarize next the audits conducted on an enterprise basis. Again, you'll see those 5 categories along the left-hand side of your screen. And we selected in the first year, 2021-22, after careful consideration and review of a variety of factors, we audited the detect function under continuous security monitoring as our first endeavor, and we tested in great detail those 8 major subcategories that you see along the right-hand side of the screen. Those 8 specific areas were audited by each of the state agency inspector generals with a final report that was issued to the agency head and to leadership, and a roll-up report was issued by the chief inspector general. As you know, the findings are exempt from public disclosure, so we're not going to talk about the exact findings here today. We wouldn't want someone listening in to expose an agency vulnerability to prevent some sort of possible exploitation. So the next audit that we selected, again using this same format, you will see in fiscal year 22-23, we selected the protect category for function for audit across the state agencies. This category has those 7 major components that you see on the right-hand side of your screen that were audited in detail that you can see here. And the findings of the audits were issued by each of the state agency inspectors general to their leadership, and then the chief inspector general's office prepared a roll-up report to summarize the findings in aggregate. Again, these findings are confidential and exempt, but it's important to note that when the agencies were looking at funding their IT risks, they used some of these audit findings to support their legislative budget requests that you may be reviewing this very session. The next category for the third enterprise-wide audit, which is just a portion of what the mission of the Inspector General was conducted across the state agencies. We selected incident response, reporting, and recovery. And you can again see it came from and was derived from the respond category. And there were five major phases of the process. Detailed audit testing was performed in each of the five phases to test the state agency's compliance with these NIST standards, rule, and the requirements report findings, where improvements were needed, were communicated to, again, to the agency heads and leadership. And a roll-up report will be issued this year by the Chief Inspector General in addition to those agency reports to their agency heads to note any patterns and trends by the end of this fiscal year. This will further assist us in baselining the state agency's compliance with NIST and Rule 60GG. Summaries of other work by the agency's inspector shed can be found online as well. But we consider this an important part of our mission. This last slide will talk or bring you to the audit planning activities that are underway for fiscal year 24-25. We have a work group of state agency inspectors general, three of which are here with me today from DMS, DOT, and DOE. And we are working to assimilate information through a variety of sources. We're looking at past incidences or issues at the agencies. We're reviewing prior audit findings. We're evaluating the vendor risk assessment results and assimilating other reports or sources of information to recommend a relevant scope for the upcoming audit that will begin in July. We will actually select that audit topic by the end of January 2024, so just imminently. And we will share that audit program in advance of our fieldwork activities with the agencies at its inception, so the agencies know exactly what we will be testing. We will also be sharing our audit program with our partners at Northwest Shared Data Center, so they know the scope of our audit, the agencies that they have service level agreements with, what they're experiencing, and the kinds of information that we're asking for during that audit. They've been a wonderful partner. We will select that audit by the end of January 2024. We will develop any new audit plan, specifically with those detailed testing that we will conduct. We will host learning sessions for any new auditors and micro-learning sessions where we provide technical support to the agency offices of inspectors general as we go through the field work and testing. We also have an Ask the CIG mailbox. It's a way that auditors, when they're in the field, they can ask questions. Let's say they encounter a particular test that they're having difficulty evaluating that artifact to determine if they meet the standard of 60GG or the NIST environment. So they can email that Ask the CIG mailbox to receive technical support while they're doing the audits. When their boots on the ground and the agency's doing this field work test, they can get immediate access to support right away. At the conclusion of this audit, we will also issue final reports by each of the agency inspectors general, and again, a roll-up report will be provided by the chief inspector general, and we will conduct follow-up as required by our professional auditing standards. I will say that this has been a tremendous effort on behalf of the Inspector General community. It is a mission of which we are very proud of being a part of. I'm honored to present on a portion of the work of the Inspectors General in the agencies. As I come to a close, Madam Chair, I submit to you that our audits conducted pursuant to this mission are an important part of the state's cybersecurity and IT governance strategy for the state to ensure our state agencies are receiving assurance activities that year immediately on what the audits that we are conducting so that they can implement corrective action in a timely manner. And if it's something that needs funding, they can submit it that year in their legislative budget request. So, Madam Chair, this concludes my prepared remarks today, and I'm certainly open to any questions at the end.
Thank you so much, Ms. Miguel, for your presentation and your work.
Thanks.
Members, that concludes the portion of the cybersecurity update presentations. We're now going to move into presentations on artificial intelligence. First up, we have David Clark, Florida Technology Council.
Thank you. name's David Clark. I'm the chair of the Florida Technology Foundation. And that is a 501c3 that's focused on technology education to ensure Floridians are ready for the future, which is dynamic and challenging. First, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and to the committee staff for being very patient and diligent, ensuring that you are receiving timely information and relevant information as it relates to AI. A lot of information to cover. My goal in my presentation is to share a few key elements with all of you. What is AI? When did AI begin? How does it work? Who is behind the curtain as it relates to different types of AI? Where is it, both personally and professionally, throughout our lives? And I'm going to end with, is it friend or is it foe? And what do we do next? So I plan on moving fast, so bear with me. As many of my friends and colleagues, I'm sure, are getting ready to bust my chops for truncating AI to an ice cube, even though it's an iceberg. But I will try to make it a fun-sized ice cube, so off we go. So what is AI? AI, in its basic form, is making machines intelligent. It is simulating through machines and systems the capability to imitate intelligent human behavior. Not only that behavior is intelligent, but this is intended to simulate and imitate intelligent human behavior. So at its core, it's to perform the cognitive functions that we would typically associate with human minds: perception, reasoning, learning, interacting with an environment around us, problem solving, and even exercising creativity. So on the bottom right side of the chart in front of you, you see a bubble. This is artificial intelligence. The goal here is to show you that it is really an umbrella term. It encapsulates an array of things. So I would also encourage you that when people come to you and refer to AI, ask more questions, because it's very much a buzzword right now, but there's much more to it than that. As you can see by some of the legs underneath that artificial intelligence bubble, there are things such as machine learning, natural language processing, robotics, data and predictive analytics. There are many aspects to it. And the image on the bottom left is intended to kind of draw a correlation. And I would ask you all to kind of frame your minds as I take you on this journey on how does AI work as it relates to human intelligence and information analysis. Just like we as humans process data in, just as we teach our children through our education systems how to process information coming in, the models that are used in order to process that information and then the decision making that comes out of that. So when did it begin? Well, here's the good news. It's been around for over 70 years. It started really in the 50s, and we're going to talk about it really from a data perspective. So it started in the 50s from the perspective of the early work by a gentleman named Alan Turing and the creation of the Turing test. So the term artificial intelligence was actually coined in 1956 at a Dartmouth conference. But go back to the Turing test. The Turing test is the idea of, does a system think humanly? So what does that mean? Well, the test is a computer and a human are asked questions to determine which is a human. If the computer is indistinguishable from the human, it passes the Turing test. So many of you in this room, if not all of you, have actually experienced a reverse Turing test. What is that? Well, a reverse Turing test is CAPTCHA. Never in my life did I imagine that I would be able to get the essence of why I am human by picking all the bicycles in the image in order to log into the system, or all the buses in the image. But that's a reverse Turing test. The goal there is, if the human passes the test, the assumption is that the machine will not be able to. So if you pass the CAPTCHA test, you are therefore human, and then you are into the system. So CAPTCHA, actually, that acronym actually stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. That's what CAPTCHA stands for. I know, horrible acronym, but in essence, that's exactly what it is. So if you have passed the CAPTCHA test, congratulations, you are apparently human. So the next level of that is acting humanly, so the cognitive sciences, and as we move into the 70s and 80s, you start getting into the world of expert systems and a focus on logic-based AI. Then as we continue to progress into the 90s, you get into a shift towards machine learning and the use of data-driven approaches, which is where we are today in a much more meaningful way. So from the 2000s to the present, it's the rise of deep learning, big data, increased computational power has really emphasized the ability to take that data and do incredible things with it. At the end of 2022, with the commercialization of AI, generative AI with ChatGPT, which you may have heard of that, it's a system designed by a company called OpenAI, ChatGPT has really emphasized and allowed the average consumer to leverage AI in ways that were not previously possible. But the real story there, it's been around for a long time, and it's doing a lot of things. So what are the stages of AI? Well, we're going to talk about three of those stages. The first one is artificial narrow intelligence. So artificial narrow intelligence is what it sounds like. It's narrow. So it's one particular area, and it performs specific tasks. It can sometimes outperform humans in that specific task, such as playing chess, or language translation, or facial recognition. But it has a limited set of constraints and contexts. They do not possess a great understanding or broader intelligence beyond that one task. Think of a machine that is designed in a manufacturing facility to pick up a widget and move it from one place to another, right? The next is AGI, or Artificial General Intelligence, which refers to machines that possess the ability to understand, learn, and apply intelligence across a wide range of tasks at a level equal to or exceeding human levels of intelligence. So AGI can theoretically perform any intellectual task that humans can do. It involves transferring and synthesizing knowledge across various domains. This level of AI requires the machine to have self-awareness, emotional understanding, and creative thinking. I would tell you that where we are today is definitely in this stage. We are taking different technologies that are siloed and bringing them together to really amplify the field of AGI. The next level is ASI, or Artificial Superintelligence. ASI represents an AI that theoretically surpasses human intelligence across almost all fields. It includes general wisdom, problem solving, creativity, and emotional intelligence. It will not only be able to mimic human intelligence, but also has the capacity for exponential learning and understanding because it does not suffer from learning loss. It continues to build upon the basis of knowledge that it possesses. The concepts of ASI extend really into the realm of hypothetical, theoretical future scenarios, but that is where the world is trying to get to as far as an ASI perspective. And then we get into future computational capabilities like quantum computing that becomes more of a reality as we look into the future. So what are the types of AI? The types of AI range from reactive, limited memory, theory of mind, and self-aware. So when you think about what I previously just shared, ANI, AGI, ASI, remember we're in artificial general intelligence, so you're going to see some correlations here. So what is reactive AI? Reactive AI is those specific stimulations or situations that it's given one stimuli, and like I said, it's a machine that moves a widget from here to there. Another example, a more sophisticated example, is IBM's Deep Blue machine that played chess and is very well known for beating a human the first time they played a chess game. But again, it's reactive. So there's an action and a reaction. That's all it does. Limited memory AI are AI systems that uses past experiences, so you can warehouse some of that information, and then use it to make future decisions. For example, self-driving cars using recent observations to navigate, right? And we have cars now that it remembers a pothole or a challenge in the road the next time it interfaces with that area. So that's limited memory. And the memory is transient, so there's a data dump. The next level is theory of mind. So this is where we're getting into that AGI area. So theory of mind is more advanced and understands emotion, people, and other entities, and can have thoughts and emotions that affect its own behavior. That's sentiment analysis. It's used in sentiment analysis marketing. It's used in social media. This level of AI requires advancements not just in understanding of verbal commands, but also nonverbal cues and social context. This is where you see systems that are using facial recognition to understand, from a data perspective, human emotion based on micro-expressions that a human is exhibiting. The next one is self-aware AI. You notice the talking points there are a little thin. That's because this is the most advanced form, and we could go down this rabbit hole for a very long time. But self-aware AI would possess its own consciousness and be self-aware, something called sentient. These systems would be aware of its own internal states and could predict feelings or feelings of others, and therefore modify its interactions based on that feedback. We're going to get a little bit into that process in just a moment. But this level AI involves not only understanding consciousness, but being able to replicate it in a machine, a feat that blends aspects of philosophical and psychological. It remains a topic of theoretical research right now, but now we're getting into the real dimensions of what makes a human, but that is where we get into the software capability. So how does it work? So I would tell you, and I'm going to have some of my colleagues yell at me for this, but from a data perspective, in its simplest form, it is actually very simple. What it can do and how it does it, based on the use case, can get incredibly complex. But in its simplest form, remember I said I'm going to take you on a journey. I would ask you to think about how you as an individual take in information, right? And you can equate this to when you're driving your car. So we all have senses. We have senses of sight, sound, smell, and touch. As you're driving your vehicle, you're taking data inputs in, right? Systems have sensors, right? They take data in. At the end of the day, it's all data coming in. And I'm not talking about the emotional, spiritual, psychological scale. I'm just talking about your data from this example is driving a car. You're driving to work in the morning, and you're taking in environmental inputs, whether it's the it's raining outside, how's my car performing, are the other drivers friendly or cranky? The sun was in my eyes this morning because I was driving east, so that was created a challenging driving experience, but you're taking in all those data elements. So how does the system replicate that? Well, that chart on the top left, you see data is being generated. That's what I was just talking about. Data is coming in to you, and it's being stored in your mind. In a system, it's being stored on a server. It's being stored somewhere in the cloud. We don't have to get into that. The next step is, what happens with that data? Well, that's where you get into the intelligence, whether it's organic, or human intelligence, or in this case, artificial intelligence. It's the data processing element. So your brain is processing the data that's coming in from your senses. Well, AI can take data coming in from sensors or input, and it can analyze that data, and then based on the models that it's using, we'll talk about that in a second, it can provide actionable insights for things that you make decisions, you act on, right? That's how that process works. So bottom right chart, ingest, if you look at where it says ingest, that's the data coming in. Then it goes into a cycle where the data is prepared and it's formatted, so there's structure given to that data, it's cleansed, it's normalized, it's put together in a way where it's understandable. And then it is moved into the model. The model, think about this as how you're trained and how school, how your life, how your experiences has created a model in your mind that allows you to process and analyze, evaluate, and what to do with the information coming in. It's identifying patterns in the information. You're on a road that has no rain, no water on it, so it's clear. That's a pattern of how you would perhaps adjust your driving. And there are different types of ways to train the model. And just like you would in school, there are supervised training, there's unsupervised and reinforced. It's the learning model. So as the data comes in, it's transformed, it's trained through the model, and then it's deployed into the execute. That's where actionable recommendations are made. And then based on those recommendations, there might be tweaks or changes. For example, you're driving, your brain says turn left, and you realize, oh, there's a curve there, don't turn left. That's the feedback loop, right? This is used quite significantly in the military, it's used in the business world. I'll refer to it as, it's called the OODA loop. The OODA loop is observe, orient, decide, act. So what is that? Observe is that decision-making process. It was, like I said, developed originally for a military strategist, but observe, you gather current information, right? That's the gathering, the data coming in. You orient, we analyze this, and you use it to update your current reality. That's the beginning of going into that model. You decide, you determine a course of action based on the observations and orientation. That's the execute part. Then you act, you implement a decision, and then that process is a loop. It's iterative and continuous. That's how our brain works as it relates to decision-making on data inputs. That's what the artificial intelligence has been designed. It's been designed to mimic how the brain works. And that OODA loop is a good explanation of how that works from a military or a business perspective. So, I know it's a lot, but at its basic form, it's really from a data perspective on AI, it's data in, what it does with the data, and then how the data is used to make recommendations and provide guidance. So how is it being used commercially? Well, here's some examples on the screen from a healthcare perspective. It's being used to diagnose diseases, remember the data in, and analyze that data rapidly, predict patient outcomes. It's there's some systems out there that can actually predict diagnoses better than text nowadays, just because the rate of error is lower. The more data that's fed into those systems, the better decision making you can make. From finance, being used for fraud detection, it's being used for algorithmic trading. From retail, for personalized recommendations, transportation, we talked about self-driving cars, AI navigation routes to avoid obstacles, like I mentioned. Customer service, AI-powered chatbots, they're 24/7 that provide an almost human-like interaction from a conversational perspective. So where is it in our daily lives? Well, this is a little bit of an eye chart, but the takeaway here is it is everywhere. It is incorporated into almost most aspects of our electronic connected lives. What you're seeing here is the concept of the IoT from an infrastructure perspective, which is the information of things. It's how our lives, our cars, our phones, our businesses, our houses are connected to the network grid and how it all communicates. And you can see some examples. Some of them you're likely familiar with. Amazon's on here from a shopping perspective. But you know, from a smartphone's perspective, it powers voice assistants like Siri, Google Assist, and camera enhancements, personalized recommendations. You ever have your photo gallery pops up and it's like, remember when? And it shows you a little slideshow that's AI driven, where it's trying to go back in time, watch your preferences, and cobble together a collage and bring it to you based on your tastes and preferences. Social media, it curates your feed and suggests content based on your preferences and iteration. That's another rabbit hole you can really go down, but it's absolutely leveraging AI. Navigation apps like Google Maps, Waze, optimize routes, looks for obstacles, and recommends new routes based on those potential hazards in the road. Online shopping, AI recommends products based on your browsing and purchasing history. Guys, I think Amazon Prime has definitely got me on that one. Streaming services like Netflix and Amazon and Spotify use AI to recommend music and videos based on your preferences. So smart devices, as you can see on the image here on the right, kind of a connected home. It's everywhere. It's in everything we have. If you have smart speakers at home, from Sonos to Amazon Echo to Google Home, many of those interpret voice commands leveraging AI, and you can use it to control your home. For example, I have a washing machine that I bought last year from GE, and it tells me when my clothes are ready, and so I want to start back up, and it senses whether it's wet or dry or all the things. And I can tell you, my wife lamented about it, so she's like, now it's going to notify the whole house when I got clothes. I'm part of that. That get the clothes out of the dryer during. Smart thermostats like Nest AI, which monitors the environment in your home and makes recommendations to try to optimize the temperature environment. Wearable fitness trackers, which is a really big thing now from the perspective of things like Fitbit and Apple Watch, where it's tracking the biometrics of an individual and the telemetry trackers and letting make decisions on healthcare. Smart security cameras for intrusion detection using facial recognition, looking for threats, and robot vacuums like Roomba, for example, which I have a couple of those in my house running around, mapping my house for me. Hopefully that's a good thing. And then in your smartphone, it's quite handily almost being leveraged in many of the apps and capabilities in your smartphone. So where is it in business? We talked a little bit about that, but customer service, marketing, personalized marketing campaigns, I've used this in one of my businesses. Supply chain management, so it optimizes inventory levels, predicts demands. So one of the challenges with economics is supply chain right now. And if you are able to do just-in-time inventory management, it allows you to reduce costs and optimize revenue. And AI has really made a significant benefit because it can optimize demand predictions and allow you to make smart acquisitions as it relates to your inventory. Human resources, AI tools are being used in the recruitment process to analyze resumes and predict candidate fit. And data analysis or reporting for business strategy and decision making. So where do we go from here? I have had the opportunity to present to many businesses who who are trying to figure out, small businesses, medium businesses, who are trying to figure out, what is this thing, what do we do with it? And interestingly enough, the number one question that I received is it good or is it evil? And my response to that is, it is inherently neither good or evil. It is a tool. It's a tool in a tool belt. And whoever controls it and what they do with it, it's just like any other tool, will determine what it becomes. I once had a quote from a friend, Dr. John Evans, who collaborates with Wellness College, and he said that even bad guys use spreadsheets. We ban spreadsheets. What that means is we figure out ways to leverage those tools in smart and more efficient ways, and provide governance and boundaries around those tools and capabilities in a way that fosters and encourages good use while protects and mitigates against use for ill. And I would tell you, people are using it for ill. You've heard today great presentations from entities like Cyber Florida and the Chief Inspector General's office, and they're doing yeoman's and yeoman's work trying to make sure that our infrastructure, our enterprise is protected and prepared. And AI is one of those tools that they can and will be using, and just like our adversaries can and are using. And the key there is they don't have any boundaries, and they don't have any guidelines. So they're using it in every way imaginable. So it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we are being smart and providing that environment. Because the future's out. For good or bad, the decisions that makes up our representative society or public will determine the future, and the future of our children, live in. And for me, that's incredibly important, as I know it is for many who have chosen to serve our state in a big and meaningful way. And I'll tell you, the future of what AI will become is transformative, it's disruptive, it's changing the world in ways that I never could have imagined 5 years ago. And I'm leveraging AI in my businesses, and it's constantly surprising me in its capabilities. And I will tell you, the iteration, the growth of it is happening. You've heard of Moore's Law. Moore's Law used to be every 2 years, technology innovates. We're at about 2 weeks right now. It completely will change itself. So I would encourage everyone to educate yourself like you're doing right now. And if you think, I've heard people say, well, David, I'm behind. How do I jump into it? I'm like, listen, jump in, start reading, start learning, because in 6 months, you're going to be right up there with everyone else, because it is changing so fast, and it's changing every industry. So think of it from the perspective of a tool that is a capability that can allow us to be more efficient, more effective in what we do and how we do things. Because if we don't use it, others will. And we have to be prepared for what the future holds. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time and your attention. And thank you for asking for this presentation, for the presentation of all the people up here leveraging AI and trying to figure out how to manage the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Next up, we will hear from Brian Fonseca, Director of the Jack Gordon Institute for Public Policy, Florida International University.
Our children are growing up in. Thanks to the transformative impact artificial intelligence is having on every aspect of our lives, and in many ways that we're just now beginning to understand. I'm honored to be here today to delve into crucial topics surrounding the governance of AI and build on the brilliant presentation of David. I'd like to focus my remarks on three key things. First, policymakers should consider legislation that directs the optimal implementation of AI technologies with the aim of enhancing public services and refining governance. Secondly, policymakers should consider legislation that outlines strategies to adapt to the economic shifts resulting from AI's disruption. And then lastly, there's a need for legislation that sets forth ethical standards and regulatory frameworks to ensure that AI is used responsibly and accountably. The legislative actions taken by this chamber regarding AI will have far-reaching and significant consequences for the future of our state. And so if you go back to the previous one, I'd like to start by talking briefly about how integration of AI stands to revolutionize the public sector in unprecedented ways. Envision AI-driven systems meticulously designed to streamline bureaucratic processes, thereby substantially reducing waiting times for essential services such as DMV visits, passport applications, notarization procedures, even jury duty management. This innovation means citizens can expect quicker, more efficient service delivery, significantly cutting down on the bureaucratic red tape that often hampers timely access to services. Moreover, AI can significantly enhance the efficiency, accuracy, and accessibility of our core public services. Beyond mere efficiency, AI systems offer the promise of improved accuracy in decision-making in public administration. By leveraging data, analytics, and machine learning, these systems can identify patterns and insights that human administrators might overlook, leading to more informed policy decisions and resource allocations. For instance, AI can be used to optimize public transportation routes, predict infrastructure maintenance needs, and analyze public health data to inform healthcare policies. Adoption of AI in the public sector could also lead to cost savings in the long run. While the initial investment in AI technologies might be significant, in fact, it will be significant, the efficiencies and effectiveness of public service will lead to reduced operational costs over time, less wastage of resources, and more strategic deployment of public sector workforce. The potential of AI to transform the public sector is vast and multifaceted. It's an opportunity for our legislators to spearhead a shift towards a more efficient, accurate, and user-friendly public sector, ultimately enhancing the quality of life for all of our constituents. Next slide, please. Secondly, AI is set to revolutionize Florida's economy, marking a paradigm shift in our economic structure and necessitating an evolution in our workforce. According to a recent McKinsey study, up to 30% of all work hours nationwide will be subject to automation, potentially leading to 12 billion occupational shifts by 2030. This surge in AI will not only create industries, but also transform existing job markets, necessitating novel skill development. Consequently, it's crucial to reflect on how this shift will influence our state's education and training programs. Investing in AI related to technology, education, and training is imperative. Such investments will equip our workforce to successfully navigate these challenges, ensuring Florida's competitive edge both nationally and globally. It's also critical to identify and support sectors that are most vulnerable to automation, guaranteeing a fair transition for workers. This legislative body holds the capacity to enact policies that foster continuous learning, endorse worker retraining, and establish safety nets for those affected by technological advancements. Next slide, please. Third and lastly, AI will revolutionize the very concept of ethical use of regulation. As we integrate AI into various facets of our life, we must ensure that public and private sectors are using this technology responsibly. We need laws and guidelines that address the algorithmic and computational biases that perpetuate discrimination. And we're seeing that effectively in case studies all around the world. We need laws and guidelines that ensure the protection of citizen privacy. And AI systems often handle sensitive data, so we need to ensure that our citizens' data is protected. And we need laws that limit the spread of disinformation through AI-powered platforms. The U.S. Department of Defense has adopted 5 ethical principles for the development of AI, and I wanted to cite those here because I find those to be some of the most impactful and reasonable ethical principles sort of governing and shaping AI development. The first is that AI development should be responsible. We must exercise appropriate judgment and care in the development, deployment, and use of AI capabilities, ensuring they remain accountable for their decisions. AI must be equitable. We should take measures to minimize unintended biases in AI systems to prevent discriminatory outcomes. It must be traceable. AI capabilities should be developed and deployed transparently with clear documentation and methodologies that are auditable, data sources, and design procedures that are transparent. This ensures that those responsible understand the technology and its processes. It must be reliable. AI systems must have a well-defined and explicit use. Their safety, security, and effectiveness should be consistently tested and assured within those defined contexts throughout their life cycles. And then finally, it must be governable. AI systems must be designed to fulfill their intended functions and have the ability to detect and avoid unintended consequences. They should also be capable of being disengaged or deactivated if they exhibit unintended behaviors. As our state legislature, each of you have the power to set robust ethical standards and regulatory frameworks around AI. By doing so, we can lead the nation in responsible AI development, ensuring it serves the public good without infringing on the individual rights and freedoms of our citizens. Last slide, please. Florida has the potential to become a national hub for innovation. With our diverse population, vibrant economy, and numerous universities and research institutions in the trenches doing really meaningful work around AI, we are uniquely positioned to lead in this field, not just for the nation, but globally. By fostering partnerships between academia, industry, and government, we can create an ecosystem that nurtures AI innovation and attracts top talent to our state. In fact, on January 19th, FIU, in partnership with Cyber Florida, my Dade College, with representation from UF and private sector across the state, we will lead the first ever Florida AI Policy Summit, where we're striving to better understand the impacts of AI across all facets of society. The program will include AI thought leaders from around the nation, and we'll produce a series of position papers on key policy themes, and I'll make sure that those are provided to the committee. I'll close with a story. This year marks 200 years since Tallahassee became the capital of Florida in 1824, and at the time it consisted of just 3 log cabins. Now, 2 centuries later, it's transformed into the capital of one of the most innovative states in this great nation. AI presents us with an unparalleled opportunity for Tallahassee to help transform the state for the next 200 years as a global AI leader. With your thoughtful leadership and foresight, we can transform our public sector, transform our economy, and transform our ethical standards to unleash AI's potential in responsible and accountable ways. Together, we can guide Florida into the future where AI not only drives economic growth, but also enhances the lives of our community. This concludes my remarks. I appreciate your attention. I look forward to any future questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fonseca. Next up, we will have Dr. Jim Zingale, Executive Director, Department of Revenue.
AI, when you're asked to present today, it's
what difference does AI make in terms of how are we running the program? Where are we using it? How is it going to be used? And is it important for a state agency to pay attention to it? But your different perspective, I've learned a lot more from the presentations that have happened so far than we're learning from me today. But if you want to understand where we are today, you've got to go back to 1990. Well, a long time ago. I think I'll follow along with the time of 1990. In 1990, the governor cabinet, the legislature challenged the Department of Revenue, but at that time it only had general tax and property tax, if it was capable to run government under business. That was a challenge that was given by the legislature and governor. What did that mean? Well, we weren't sure, and we started down a 10-year journey. That 10-year journey started with the legislature helping us reorganize an agency by business processes as private sectors. The way our budget is structured and how our statute is structured, we are organized by within that, we took that 10 years to go about partnering with the legislature primarily to do massive changes in the law about income child support, income tax administration, and in those law changes to streamline those work systems. If you will, work systems was strange to me. My first 18 years, I was part of the legislative appropriation program. What's the work system and how does that translate down to AI? Well, those work systems that we were identifying soon became popular in the interaction with the legislature. And they transferred over in 1990 to the child support program and say, whatever you're trying to do on the tax side, try to do over here on the child support side. And so we continued that journey and reorganized the social service program by business process, again, partnering with the legislature. At that point in time, governor and cabinet said, we like what you're doing, we want you to have the best computer systems in the world. And the legislature invested in two major IT transformations, one in SunTax with an SAP background to do tax administration, and one in child support, again, an SAP application to do child support. And that journey continued until 2020, we had stood up the computer systems, we've done the transformation, and I'm only going to give you a quick highlight. What was the benefit of all that? And where was AI appearing in all those discussions? If you go back to 2020, when that transformation was finished, the Department of Revenue had a little more than 5,000 people who run child support, general tax, and property tax. Today, the state of Florida grew by 8 million, and by more than 8 million people in the state. And with that, more registered tax filers, giant increase in the revenue coming to the Department of Revenue managed. Similarly, that kind of growth took place in all of our programs, including child support. But today, we have fewer people wanting the Department of Revenue than we did in 2020. Fewer general tax people, fewer property tax people, fewer child support. And while the definition of what caused that transformation into the modern computer systems that we put in place, to a large degree is AI. And you know what? What's that got to do with AI? If you look at the first block up there that says rule-based automation, automate respective actions, simplify, assist, no learning. Okay? The simples, I call it AI old school. Okay? You heard it in the continuum of where does machine learn and find its way into the system. But we looked in there and we had this motivational driver that caused great productivity and results every year. The business process, the technology, that caused great productivity. On the cut cost, raise productivity side, that enabled us to automate machine learning. If the workflow, and remember, we're trying to follow the law. We don't want a lot of creative interpretation. this process work goal level if it was defined clearly, if it was repetitive, if it could be automated every year, not just the next 10 years, every year since then, we looked at those business processes and called it old school AI, went through the process of redefining the workforce. Okay. Just think about 8 more million people running around and you don't need any more people running around. And every year, we offer up more FTE than you would need. Park that for a moment. So that's AI. Okay, I think you've heard it in the presentation. I mean, to us, that's a major benefit. Right? To the legislature, that's being able to run a program at better service than we did back in 2020. A much more larger population to serve, okay? And that's that first vector. If you go for the next vector and say, how much are we invested in virtual assistants and logic-based automation? We're just starting down that journey. And when you get to the far right-hand side, not much at all. But my presentation on my piece was to say to you, it's not just a fad, okay? It's an ongoing business opportunity in every state agency that can leverage AI to look at their workflows and make them more productive. Okay? We have one example and only one example of where we have taken the second block, the thinking part, in virtual assistants, and Coffin's been our board director in child support for many, many years, and part of that 10-year transformation. She's going to give you a quick feel of what one of those other AI applications are like, and then Jimmy, the data center director that knows how to work my computer over here, is going to give you a little idea of what we're thinking about for the future. So if that intro here, Dan.
Thank you, Ms. Coffin.
Good morning, and thank you for letting us share just one practical application of AI in the child support program. So 2 years ago, the child support program implemented a virtual assistant. Why did we do that? We receive over 1.2 million in-person call or chat inquiries from the families that we serve. And we wanted to provide a way for customers to navigate information on our web page more easily. We provide a lot of information on our web page, but child support can be very complex. It's a very legal process, there's a lot of terminology. So is there a way that we could leverage AI to help customers find general information on the web page? So we implemented DORA, which stands for Department of Revenue Answers. It's built on a conversational AI platform. It responds to over 200 general, general information questions. So most common questions that our platform receives is how to make a payment. I've received a pass-through notice, what do I do now? I received a notice for my driver's license suspension, what do I do? Another popular one is how to contact us, our families like to contact us. I can tell you that our platform does not interact with our statewide automated system. It does not access any confidential information or case-specific information. It's simply general information that citizens can access 24/7. Our virtual assistant was programmed, it's trained, and it's maintained by Department of Revenue staff. I think you heard earlier today there are platforms that will generate content. Our platform does not generate any content. We draft all the content ourselves, and we train it and map questions that customers are asking to the pre-existing responses. We take our responsibility very seriously with our AI virtual assistant, and we are constantly monitoring the conversations between the virtual assistants and our families. That helps us identify new information needs. You know, last month we may have been asking about one topic, now we're moving into federal offsets and maybe asking about different information areas, so we want to monitor those and put out new content as they're news-wise. It also helps us teach the platform if there were better responses. In a real short, simple terms, what our virtual assistant does, it assesses the words that the customer is putting in their question, It tries to map that to our pre-existing set of responses. It tries to find the best response possible. We present that to the customer. The customer has an opportunity to rate that or have follow-up questions, and that conversation can go back and forth. We receive about 50 interactions a day, and each interaction averages about 2.5 questions. Based upon the success of our virtual assistant and the child support program, the department is seeking to expand the use of virtual assistants across the Department of Revenue. One application will be a very similar virtual assistant, but it will be placed on the general tax public web pages, again, to assist businesses and others navigate the general tax administration. We've also found several applications that would be helpful to our internal team members, and that would be creating a virtual assistant for common technical questions or team members that are searching for information related to payroll, vendor payments, etc. Our goal is to have one solution agency-wide, but we would have separate knowledge bases or libraries that each of the programs could maintain with their subject matter experts. And that is our child support virtual assistant. I'm going to turn it over to Jimmy Carroll now to talk about other AI applications within Revenue.
Thank you. Mr. Carroll, we are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As we've heard from David Clark, AI has been around for many, many years. Within the Department of Revenue, we use a form of AI identified as narrow AI, or David referred to as reactive AI. This type of AI refers to artificial intelligence systems that are designed and trained to perform these task or a specific set of tasks. Unlike the general AI, which has the ability to understand and learn, narrow AI is focused on particular tasks or actions. Common examples of reactive AI or narrow AI include virtual assistants, image recognition software, and language translation services, as David mentioned earlier. The development and deployment of narrow AI within DOR offers significant advantages in streamlining specific processes and improving efficiency. Some of the specific areas that we use AI within DOR includes rule-based case processing. This automates the movement of cases within our system based on predefined rules, reducing manual intervention and improving accuracy and efficiency. This allows staff members to focus on more complex cases. We also use AI in our bachelor program scheduling, initiation, and monitoring services. In both child support and general tax, data and system updates are performed nightly, as most agencies do batch processing. The scheduling and initiation of these jobs, these batch jobs, are automated to ensure optimal performance. In addition to this, we monitor for the success or failure of these jobs, and the tool automatically reinitiates these based on those failures. We also, similar to batch processing, we migrate code from QA systems into production systems in an automated fashion. Within our property tax oversight, we use automation to transfer data from one application that is uploaded from county property tax rolls from one application to another to do data analysis on those data. The department also uses optical character recognition, or OCR, to scan tax data and checks for processing in an automated fashion. Data from the tax returns are scanned and uploaded into SciTax directly. Additionally, the department uses OCR to scan HR and financial documents into a digital format. This reduces paper storage within the agency and allows us to comply with the retention requirements. Looking at cybersecurity or security aspects on where we use some AI tools. the ads we've heard today in some of the presentations on both sides, the bad actors are using AI, and I have to be able to use AI to combat those actors. So we use AI-based tools to allow us to scan information systems for vulnerabilities, proactively identifying and mitigating security risk. We also recently completed the implementation of an enterprise application and infrastructure performance monitoring tool. That's a mouthful. This has a very powerful AI engine that's on top of it that allows me to detect and respond to anomalies in an automated fashion. This allows my security operations center to analyze, identify, and predict performance issues that might impact customer experiences in real time and allows us to respond accordingly. As Brian mentioned just before me, policy and procedures are an important factor when it comes into AI. With the rapid deployment and the public availability of generative AI tools, the department is working to create AI use policy and procedures. This will allow us to establish clear guidelines for generative AI use, including ethical considerations, data privacy, transparency, and accountability. At the same time, we're looking at all of our existing policies and procedures to ensure AI technologies comply with regulations where it relates to federal taxpayer information that we possess. As we move forward, Ann mentioned about our LDR that we have to expand DORA, our virtual assistant. We're also looking to automate some additional code testing. Application testing and security testing will enhance our code review, allowing us to identify points of failures before we go into production on the system. Additionally, we are looking to automate access management of our SAP systems from both child support and internet tax. This will allow us to grant access based on predefined policies and roles, reducing the risk of unauthorized access and potential data breaches. One last topic here, we are wanting to automate our communications with our taxpayers and external customers. Currently, through nightly batch processing, notices to taxpayers are printed and mailed manually. By offering an automated, safe, and encrypted electronic mail option as a form of communication, the department can reduce printing and postage calls and better secure sensitive data and increase taxpayer education and compliance. And this form of communication, automated communication, is a form of AI, and it has become widely accepted and adopted across many industries. So thank you for allowing us to present this, and we will have any questions.
Thank you so much. Thank you to each of our presenters today. Members, we'll now move into any questions you may have in the presentations, but please note that if the response might contain confidential information, the presenter may not be able to fully answer your question, but please feel free to ask questions and use this opportunity to gain any valuable information. Representative Holcomb, you're recognized.
I guess this question probably more applicable to Mr. Clark, but so if I Google something like do masks work for COVID or something like that, I'm going to get articles based on one guy's opinion, some other person's opinion, all sides of the argument. And Google can decide which ones they want me to see. If I'm asking the same question of AI, is it going to be finding facts, finding other, how can it be more factual, or is it going to be more like Google where it can be manipulated in coming up with answers?
Mr. Clark?
Thank you, great question. It really depends on the type of model that the AI is using. So I'm going to use ChatGPT, like 3.5 or 4, because I'm using 4 right now in one of my companies. It's the model that's trained to use and how it's going to respond. The difference between Google, which is a one-to-one or one-to-many matching, which is looking for your keywords across articles or information, where with GPT-4, for example, it's generative AI. So it's creating content to respond to you, but it is relying on a corpus of information in order to respond in a generative text way to give you original content and original response. Can it be manipulated? Well, it depends on how you train the models. Just like you would train an individual through education, you can put governance around it that would answer it based on certain sets of data. And so that's why it's key around the model, the governance of that information will drive the outcome and the response.
So some of the things you just said, yes, please, Madam Chair. So it's like we have things out there, because I'm in a political world, we have fact checks. So now AI may have fact checks of the AI fact checker?
In theory, yes. Okay. The tools that are going to be using AI to generate information that might be untruthful or misleading, there are tools that are being generated that can verify and validate what the information being provided was in fact based on factual information or misinformation. So yes, you will have fact checkers checking the fact checkers, like CPA and all that.
Representative Magger.
Wow, there's a lot to listen to. A couple of things, I guess your comments. Can I comment or question?
Let's
start with your question. Four or five questions. On cybersecurity, this is big business. How can we, or what can we do as a state? And I don't even know how much money this would take to make sure our people's data is protected. As we go to more of a cashless society, and that's a whole other argument we can have one day. It doesn't take much for somebody's chip not to work. And then you can't buy your groceries. You can't do something because somebody has hacked it, somebody has done this. How is this battle playing out? How does AI maybe help with this? Start off with one question.
All right. Who would like to tackle that one? Mr. Clark?
I think a key part to start that conversation is identity verification and validation. So as our information gets further and further digitized, so there is a digital manifestation of who we are through our phones, through our cloud presence, the key is how do we continue to tie the individual to their electronic persona, right? Because what you're talking about is fraud and where bad actors are stepping in between. And they're allowed to secure the electronic version of you and then use that to perpetrate identity fraud and financial fraud. So I think a key step is the identity verification validation of is the person who they say they are, and AI is a significant tool being used by financial institutions for exactly that fraud detection. Matter of fact, the Department of Commerce is leveraging AI in ways to ensure that individuals who are applying for services and benefits are in fact who they say they are. So it's being leveraged, but I think where it starts is making sure that an individual's identity is secure, protected, verified, and validated. That's where it all starts. It's going back to protecting that PII, personally identifying information.
And we're going to have the Chief Inspector General, Miguel, just add something to that as well.
Thank you for the question. Your question is very broad, and I will attempt to try to narrow it a little bit from a perspective. So the state of Florida, with its adoption of the NIST control framework, has certain rules and compliance points that need to be incorporated into each of the state agencies. So some of those functions are referenced in that NIST framework. So the agencies have to comply with those variety of functions that include categories, and those categories will be audited by the inspectors general to make sure that they are implemented in the agencies. But the agencies have to embrace and adopt and comply with each of these elements, such as data governance, or possibly identity and access management, possibly doing continuous security monitoring of their networks. There's a variety of those elements that you're talking about in the broad category that I think are addressed through the NIST framework. So our agencies must comply with those elements. I that we will be auditing for the therapy funds. I hope that clarifies a little bit.
Representative Madden, follow up.
There's Mud. thank you for that. And you have an answer. This is an area that is so broad, especially for somebody like me. Can I have a follow-up?
Yeah, one more follow-up, and then we're going to see who else has questions.
On the AI part, I think the concerning thing, or here's my question, is that you said, Mr. Clark, at the beginning, that AI, per your definition, is trying to be human behavior. What human are we trying to be? And who decides that? Because what may be the human for me is not the human for you. And who is this group that decides what this is going to be? Because it's not going to be me unless AI, so I'm having Rainey Magger's own AI system. And I can do that, but that would be very limited and very small. Right. So, who is this setting this up?
Mr. Clark, to the best that you can, that the human is not Randy Magger, who is the human?
Well, if you'd like to talk about it, I can help you set up a large language model that would impersonate your decision-making process. That could be a fun.
That would be short. Okay, that's 30 seconds. What's the problem with that?
The real answer to the question is it's intended to imitate human behavior, intelligent. I kind of quit that not all human behavior is intelligent. What this is trying to do is the decision-making process that a human would use when it's ingesting information through senses, and then replicate that through an artificial or synthetic way. Right? How does that decision-making process work? Which is why I threw in the OODA loop discussion, because that's how the military is taking the decision-making process and map it out into an actual process. Your question about who, well, there are an array of people who are creating training models. So it's akin to the education system. What kind of outcomes do you want in your students when they get out on the other side of advanced education, right? It's the training models that those institutions have. I know we can go into academic institutions and where they stand at present day, but the goal of a training model is to create governance around this is how we want our students to be trained. Here are the standards, here are the guidelines, here are the boundaries. It's the same thing with AI. The governance model that you create around the training models, that will determine the outputs, just like training a human, it's how you train the individual. So once again, it's a tool. And how you use that tool will determine the outcomes, the benefits, or the negatives.
Thank you, and we're going to go to Mr. Fonseca to add to that.
Yeah, just to add on, and David's absolutely right. It's a brilliant question, and I think that's why so much of the policy community today is pursuing accountable and responsible AI, right? Ensuring that the development of systems is, one, accountable to those that govern sort of the landscape, and then two, is that they're adhering to the principles of responsible AI. And so it's for that specific reason that these systems can be developed in ways that sort of encourage biased computational outcomes, which then undermine, I think, many of the ethical concerns that I've raised, David's raised, and others have raised, in terms of the implementation of AI systems across a broad landscape. And so the point being is that there is no foolproof way right now to mitigate that. It's the constant pursuit of accountable or accountability in the development of these systems, and the pursuit of responsible AI as we implement these across all facets of society.
Thank you. Representative Chamberlain, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think these are relatively quick questions, but let me go ahead and ask. Has the development, you said responsible AI, you used that phrase, so that means there's irresponsible AI possibly as well. Has the irresponsible AI, is it contributing to the cybersecurity problem? Faster it develops, is the cybersecurity problem developing equally faster and faster and faster?
Mr. Fonseca?
Yeah, it's another really good question. And I think, irresponsible AI, if we frame it that, it exists today, right? Because there's such a rush to integrate AI into marketplaces that we're not fully, you know, sort of understanding of the left and right lateral limits of what that, you know, what kind of power that AI unlocks. And so we have seen cases in which AI has been implemented in places like the Administration of Justice, and sort of computational biases have really undermined, you know, the efficacy of the outputs of those machines in terms of driving decisions on issues like recidivism, for example, right? And so that exists. When you sort of, you know, combine that with the cybersecurity space, right, which are interconnected but seemingly different spaces, you know, certainly the movement towards, you know, pushing this into the marketplace and not having the kind of security protocols in place to protect physical systems, network, software, and applications, I think is where you start to see the convergence of how the rush to put machines out there without the requisite security provisions sort of converges with and exacerbates, I think, the cybersecurity problems as well.
Thank you. Mr. Aldrich, I did have a question for you. Who is able to participate in the training program? I want to make sure that the committee fully understands who can participate in that.
Absolutely. Another good question, because we have had some questions in that regard. You know, people calling, can I participate? It's for all state, local, territorial, and tribal employees. And once in a while, as Brian knows, at FIU, somebody will say, well, I have a contractor who works with the but that's not who it's intended for. The contractors should be able to become ready to do their jobs. So the state, local, and territorial, and tribal employees across the country.
Thank you. I'm sure we could keep asking questions all day long, and I appreciate everyone's patience this morning as we had some technical difficulties. And I appreciate all of you that traveled up here to Tallahassee today or came locally to take the time out of your day to present to us. This is obviously a growing issue, not only here in the state of Florida, but throughout the world. And we want to make sure that we're at the top of our game on it, and we plan to continue to work on this and focus on this issue. So thank you to each of you for your time today. I appreciate it. This concludes our agenda. Representative Mooney moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Very good.